Today, Veterans Radio is dedicated to all those troops who were part of the American Army that liberated the concentration camps in Europe.
Live from the Veterans Radio Studio and the Ave Maria Network, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host for today, Gary Lilly.
And good morning, everybody. Welcome to Veterans Radio, a fascinating program that we're having today. Lila Levinson, who wrote the book Gated Grief, will be on with us as a guest. And this book, Gated Grief, came about when her father passed away, and going through the belongings, they found photographs of the concentration camps of Europe, and, well, one particular concentration camp. Her father was a doctor in the Army in World War II, up on the front lines, near the front lines, and had to do the medical treatment on some of these. And General Eisenhower said to the troops, take as many photographs as you can, because someday people will be denying that the concentration camps actually existed. And of course, that's the stuff you hear out of Iran and other places now, that they never did exist. So we'll be coming on to talking to Lila in a few minutes. And right now, we want to say welcome home to all of the troops that are serving around the world. And it looks like a lot of you will be coming home in the near future. We're proud of you. We older vets, we are very proud of you. And we thank you for the job you're doing, because you're very good at what you do and keeping things like these concentration camps from happening again as much as possible. Welcome home.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
As our troops went off to war, they were listening to the upbeat music of the 1930s and 40s, the big band era, the small band era, and a lot of talented people out there. They came back different, and we're going to be talking a bit about why they came back different to Lila. I forgot to mention that Dale Thronberry was going to be the host today, but had a medical emergency with his mother-in-law in New Jersey, so he briefed me at breakfast this morning on what I was going to be doing and talking about, and then he left off to pick up his wife, whose 88-year-old mother broke her arm and her hip, and our thoughts are with you and our prayers are with you, Dale and Jane, and with Jane's mother. So have a safe trip out there to New Jersey. As I mentioned on the dedication, and the I got to tell you that you get up in the morning and you're thinking about really upbeat things and all that, and then you see this book and some of the photographs that you guys are going to be looking at today. And I should warn you, if you're on webcam watching us on the internet, some of these photographs are going to be very graphic. We do have the photographs, do we, Kai? Okay, they're loaded up, and they're going to be very graphic, so if it disturbs you, you might want to listen and not watch. Lila Levinson, you wrote Gated Grief. Welcome to Veterans Radio, and Tell us why you did this. Good morning, Lila.
Good morning, Gary. It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
Well, we appreciate your being on here. And as I look at this book, you did a marvelous job for a marvelous service, I should say. And I haven't had a chance to read it, but it looks like you did a marvelous job just scanning through it. What caused you to write this book?
Well, as you said in the opening of the show, I found photographs after my father passed away. They were in his army trunk down in the basement of his medical office. And though I had known a bit about his time in the war, I knew that he had been right there on D-Day on Utah Beach, right behind the first wave of troops. I knew that he had gone through France and Belgium and had been at the Battle of the Bulge. That was really all I knew, and I never thought about my father's World War One service. You know, like so many people of my generation, our fathers fought in the war, and we just sort of took it for granted and never even thought about it. But when I found this box of photographs, my father evidently recorded his entire time in Europe, starting with crossing the English Channel all the way into Germany. And thank goodness he was a pretty meticulous man, so he made notations on the back of each one where and when he had taken it. And at the bottom of the box were images that you referred to just now that people might find very disturbing. And they were extremely disturbing. They were shocking to me. They were images of countless skeletal bodies, many of them in striped pajamas. And the backs of them said Nordhausen Concentration Camp, April 12, 1945. There was one that showed bodies lined up in these endless canal-shaped graves. And that one said the burial of the victims of Nordhausen, April 15, 1945. And I just really couldn't understand what these photographs were doing with my father's and why it was his handwriting on the backs of them. Because my father hadn't witnessed a camp, because surely he would have mentioned that to us. Surely he would have shared with us, you know, why we needed to make sure a Holocaust never happened again. And it was really only when my aunt, a few days later, told me that, yes, my father's division had liberated Nordhausen. It was where the Nazis made the V-1 rockets that firebombed England. And then she went on to say, Lila, he, being a doctor, had to stay to treat the survivors, and after a few weeks, he had a mental breakdown. And that information was just so astounding to me. I just couldn't begin to even take in that news. So why I started writing the book was, And what I did then was, it took me 12 years. 12 years before I was really ready to deal with this. And it was only after I started teaching a Holocaust literature class at a university here in Austin, and my students were the ones who raised the question for me when they read about the trauma of survivors and how that trauma became their children's trauma. And then my students, after reading some oral histories by liberators, asked, did the trauma of the liberators affect their children? That was a huge moment for me. It was almost like, you know, my students opened up this path for me that I realized I had to go down.
Had you told your students that?
I told them that. I mean, I spoke there a few months ago, and I told my students, you know, I owe this book to you. That students often don't recognize how they teach the teachers as much as the teachers teach them.
If the teacher's a good listener, and obviously you are, that is not a gift. It's a gift, but it also says a lot about the teacher when they listen to the younger people.
Well, thank you so much. It was an honor, really, to teach that course.
Had you told the students that your father was one of the liberators?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes, although I hadn't shown them the photographs yet at that point. But much to my amazement, so this was just, let's see, in 2003. Much to my amazement, I couldn't find any books at all on how liberating the camps, witnessing the camps, affected the GIs psychologically and emotionally. And in fact, there really were only a couple of books on the liberation of the camps at all. One written by a colleague of mine here in Austin, Robert Abzug. He wrote that book in 1985 called The Inside the Vicious Heart, which is a history of which divisions liberated which camps and when and what they saw there. So so it started as a personal mission because I suddenly realized maybe my father's witnessing the camps explained a tremendous amount about him that I never could understand. My father was a study of contradictions. At his office, his medical office, when I would go in there to visit him, I would see this sweet, congenial man, very warm and affectionate with his patients, always had his arm around them. They called him Dr. L very affectionately. He was beloved by his patients. And at home, he was silent, he was distant, emotionally, completely no emotions, unless anger, and very almost brusque with my brothers and me. My mother had become an alcoholic and a kleptomaniac in my years, and by the time I was five, she was taken from our lives, taken from me in a police station very, very traumatically, with her wailing that if I left her, I'd never see her again. And my father was actually just down the steps of the police station waiting for me, so he heard all this terrible stuff going on. And yet he never, ever was willing to talk about her with me, never willing to explain what happened to her, never willing to acknowledge that my brothers and I had this terrible grief that just became huge depression in our home. So we grew up in this deafening silence. And I never could understand that because I could see that my father was a kind-hearted man. So when my students talked to, you know, asked that question about the trauma of the liberators, I realized this might help me understand my father and ultimately forgive him, because after he died, rage towards him that I had repressed my whole life just surfaced. And that felt almost intolerable to me, to have that combination of grief and rage towards the same person. So I set off across the country interviewing all the veterans I could find who had liberated camps. I wrote them letters asking if I could come speak with them. I got back letters from about a half of them, and I spent a summer traveling around the country meeting these men and seeing, much to my utter amazement, how they were still in the grips of the trauma of liberating those camps.
I want to go back to something you said that just struck me as very telling. Your father was at D-Day. He went throughout France and Belgium, treating troops, you know, the wounds that troops suffer in combat are not the John Wayne, you know, take a bullet and say some soft last words and goodbye to everybody and then close the eyes. And I'm picturing some of those World War II movies. The wounds they take are so traumatic that they're difficult to look at. And so somebody like, and your father was in the Battle of the Bulge, and the things that he saw were terrible beyond description, but yet it was the concentration camps that caused him to have a nervous breakdown.
Yes, and it was really fascinating, Gary, how many of the veterans I met said to me, the rest of the war paled in comparison. And they, too, had been through the worst of the worst.
Oh, my.
That spoke volumes.
Yes, it does, and that's something that, you know, when I'm doing an interview, preparing for the interview, I'm trying to put myself in the person's shoes, and in this case, both in yours and your father's, and what it must have been like for the liberators. My brother Gene has a story. I don't know if he'll phone in later on. He told me earlier this week that he's going to listen for sure to this program because of the experience that he had in the mid-50s. And how it affected him and how the sergeant that he worked for reacted to what my brother saw. Very traumatic. I'll give him a chance to tell the story if he phones in. But your father had all of these photographs, and they were tucked away. Why do you think he took the photographs?
Well, you know, I can only deduce that from what other veterans shared with me. And that first brings me to an interesting point, Gary, which is that the World War II was the first war that the average soldier was able to document it. You know, they all had Kodak Brownie cameras
right.
tucked away in their duffels, even though they weren't supposed to. So many of them did. Or by the end of the war, they had, you know, found, you know, German cameras that they took. And so many of these men came home with photographs. And to my amazement, there are so many children of veterans liberators like myself who only found out about their fathers having witnessed a camp from finding the photographs after their fathers died. It's uncanny to me. And so the veterans I met who took photographs told me they did because, like you mentioned, Eisenhower, they knew that nobody at home would be able to believe it or begin to imagine it unless they actually saw a photograph of it.
So they
really believed that they were the documenters, that they were going to be the witnesses and providing the testimony.
That shows you how much they were affected by that and how they firmly believed that the world can never forget the evil that took place. I put myself in that position. I would want to be photographing everything I could, as distasteful as it might be, because even if you're standing there looking at it, you could not comprehend, I'm absolutely certain, what was taking place during that period of time before you got there, when the Germans were running the concentration camps. But one of the things Dale told me he learned about in your book was that I always thought that, geez, there must have been at least a dozen of these big camps throughout Germany and Poland and Czechoslovakia, wherever. How many camps were there?
Well, yeah, that was one of the things that just totally amazed me. When I began to realize just how traumatized on a whole nother level the liberators had been by what they had witnessed and by how none of them had talked with their children about it, none of them. I mean, almost to a single veteran, they have all been silent about what they witnessed, and we can talk about that in a few minutes. I realized that this has had, you know, a ripple effect through many, many families, so I wanted to get a sense how many families, how many GIs went through this extremely, extremely traumatizing experience and were witnesses. And how I began to understand what that number might be was when I came upon an astounding fact that after the Berlin Wall fell and we finally had access to the Nazi archives that had gone into the hands of the Soviet Union at the end of the war, we learned from those archives that the concentration camp system was much more vast than we ever imagined. There were 23,000 camps.
What? No, say that again?
23,000. And, you know, you ask an average person on the street, I asked a group of educators last week, how many camps do you think there were? Some people said 5, some people thought 20. You know, we think of Dachau, Buchenwald, Mauthausen.
Auschwitz.
Well, in Auschwitz, right, the extermination camps, you know, which were all located out to the east of Germany. They didn't put any of those in Germany. The Soviets were the ones who liberated those. But just the ones that were located where they didn't actually, you know, commit mass murder through gassing, but used the prisoners as slaves and let them just die from starvation and disease. How many of those? And, you know, what the Nazis did was that they, like when we say the word Buchenwald, that wasn't just one camp. That was a system of camps. that comprised over 180 subcamps alone in that one system. For instance, I was reading a memoir of a World War II medic just this last week, and they didn't liberate a camp per se, but they did liberate three different groups of prisoners. There were 45 in one group, there was 150 in another, where these prisoners were taken to small towns and used as slave laborers. And that might not have been trauma on the scale of walking into Buchenwald's main camp itself, but the people they found had been almost starved to death, had been living as slaves and being raped and terribly abused and diseased, you know, for years. So you can't say that that wasn't trauma to some degree. So when I figured out how many camp systems the GIs liberated from the U.S. Holocaust Memorial website and their, you know, what they recognize as the official liberating troops, and then multiplied those number of camps by the typical number of men that would be in a battalion, I came up with at least 300,000 GIs witnessed camps. Because you also need to factor in that they had to bring in engineering corps, they had to bring in medical units, and then Eisenhower ordered any battalion within 100 miles of a camp to send two men to be witnesses because of how he amazingly foresaw that there would be Holocaust deniers someday.
I, of course, talked to a lot of veterans, not just through Veterans Radio, but I talked to them, you know, through other sources, and I can picture in my mind the flashbacks. Every time I talk to a World War II guy who was amongst the liberators of these camps, after war, a lot of times GIs together will talk about things, and even if there are bad things, you know, you kind of laugh about it, you know, geez, I was scared, or you know, that kind of stuff, and. So a lot of the guys, the World War II guys, are talking the normal GI stuff to each, to us and to each other and such. And you always try to remember and talk about the humor of it with a few moments about the people I was with, what great people they were, and the bravery was astounding and such. And when they bring up the concentration camps, or when the concentration camps come up, their lips tighten. And they'll say something like, yeah, I saw them. And that's it. That's it. But their lips tighten. And I noticed that when I was a guardian on the one of those honor flights taking troops back to see the World War II Memorial. And always in great moods and talking and everything. And one guy was telling me, I forget what unit he was in, about how good a unit it was and blah, blah, blah. And then, I don't mean blah, 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 but I mean all the stuff he was talking about. And then he said, and we liberated such and such a camp. And his lips tightened and his eyes stared straight ahead 50 years ago, 60 years ago, and that was it.
Yeah. I went to the dedication of the World War II Memorial, and I just walked around the Washington Mall, and I would go up to men and ask them if they had liberated a camp. And when the men answered yes, almost not a single one of them was willing to talk to me about it.
How did you get those interviews? How did you get the people to talk to you?
Well, like I said, I wrote a letter which, gave a person some advance warning, gave them some time to think about it. And about half said, yes, come visit. And I am so in debt to those men and one woman that I found, because they were extremely, not just only generous in opening their homes to me, but in opening their memories.
Why do you think they did that?
And that's a complex question, Gary, and I have three possible answers. One is that their stated reason, which was that they wanted to again put their testimony into the historical record. And another reason was that I presented myself as a daughter of a fellow liberator, and that my father had passed away, and that I would so much like to understand what his experience had been. And so I think my being the age of their own children, and this gets to sort of an unconscious reason, was that while they couldn't tell their own children, I think they felt somewhere inside that by telling me, they would be able to tell their children, and that has indeed what has happened, because then when I sent them a copy of the manuscript because I wanted to make sure they were comfortable with everything I had said, they then gave that manuscript to their children. And the children, that was how their children found out about their father's experience.
So the children or the wife were not there when you were doing the interview?
Only in one case was the daughter present with her father, and I'd like to get back to that in a few minutes, why their relationship was pretty special. But I got letters from the children that really just made me cry when I got them, because they expressed tremendous gratitude for the difference that I had made in the lives of their families by opening up this part of their father's past, and that by the children knowing and understanding now what their fathers had endured, what was behind their father's silence, it had broken that silence and opened up conversations that the children had been yearning to have, that created a whole different level of intimacy within that family. And, you know, it was bittersweet for me because I was able to do for them what I obviously couldn't do for myself because my father was gone. But because that was what was so painful for me, was to recognize what my father had carried all alone for so many years. And I knew that he had done that to protect us, because every soldier comes home from war more than anything else wanting to create security for their children, having a safe family. And so they feel like they can't do anything with their horrible memories but to go silent, because how can you begin to share that? But I think the one thing I would love your audience to know is that silence does not protect children. That children know that something is being withheld, and they absorb the consequences of the silence, which is melancholy and depression, and they also blame themselves for the silence. They feel like, well, they must not be doing something right or must not be lovable enough that a parent has to have a secret from them. So I am working with veterans now with writing workshops so that they find a safe way to start getting their memories out, to start processing them, so that when the day comes when their children are old enough, they'll be able to share, and they'll be able to share with their spouses, and there won't be that horrible, horrible deadening silence in their families.
Well, my mind is jumping all over as you're talking, and one of the things that is sinking into me, there's a lot of Vietnam vets say that the worst thing they ever did the first time they went to the wall was to go with their wife or their girlfriend. And the best thing is to do it with another Vietnam veteran or other Vietnam veterans, because the wife or the girlfriend never know what to say, and they always try to say something comforting, and it never is the right thing. And the right thing, of course, is just to be quiet and hug and not say, oh, we should have never been there. Boy, that's like putting a knife in your gut. But
right.
The thing of it is, those people were able to open up to you because you were simply listening and not trying to comment, I imagine, as you were doing the interviews. You were pulling the story out of them as opposed to trying to comfort them, which can't be done, I guess.
Right,
Am I close?
No, you are close. I mean, and I think families, and this is often what I am trying to advocate right now, is that spouses and children need as much support as the returning veteran, because they need to learn what you just said. You know, because in our society, we are not at all comfortable with grief and loss, and so we're all new at this. You know, nobody learns this from their parents growing up. How do you respond, to somebody in tremendous emotional pain?
We're coming up on a break, Lila. We're listening to Lila Levinson, whose book Gated Grief is one that all children of veterans should read. We'll be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Sergeant Roy Harmon, although wounded twice, continued his assault on the enemy machine gun emplacements. Details after this.
On the way to your college degree, you've hit some roadblocks. You decide it's time to change direction. The Air Force can help. We offer educational assistance, high-tech job training, and experience. The credits you've earned may help you start your Air Force career at a higher rank, and we'll pay off your student loans up to $10,000 if you qualify. For more information, call 1-800-423-USAF or log on at airforce.com. Cross into the blue with the U.S. Air Force. No one comes close.
Harmon was acting squad leader when heavy machine gun fire from German positions stopped his company's advance and pinned down one of the platoons. Ordered to rescue the platoon, he led his squad forward against three key positions. His squad fired tracer bullets in an attempt to set fire to the three haystacks. Harmon ordered his squad to hold their position and began a one-man assault. Carrying white phosphorus grenades, Harmon crept to within 25 yards of the first position. He set the haystack afire with a grenade, and when two of the enemy attempted to flee, he killed them with his machine gun. Crawling toward the second machine gun emplacement, he was wounded, but continued to advance and destroyed the position with hand grenades, killing the occupants. He then attacked the third machine gun. About halfway to his objective, he was again wounded, but he struggled ahead until within 20 yards of the machine gun nest, where he raised himself to his knees to throw a grenade. He was knocked down by direct enemy fire. With a final effort, he again rose, hurled a grenade, and fell dead, riddled with bullets. His grenade set the third position on fire, destroying it.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
That song, Kiss Me Once and Kiss Me Twice and Kiss Me Once Again. It's been a long, long time. That's the type of music that the troops came back to. And we're talking to Lila Levinson, whose father was a doctor at the discovery of one of the concentration camps in Europe. And it affected his entire life, and it affected the life of Lila and her siblings. Lila, give us an example of some of the people that you interviewed that had never talked to their family about the stories, their stories on the liberation of the camps.
Sure, I'd be honored to. One that immediately comes to mind is a man named George Kaiser, who lives outside of Boston. His division actually didn't liberate Dachau. He was on a supply run and saw all this commotion on the road outside of Munich, and asked one of the soldiers what was going on, and he said, "We've discovered one of those camps down the road from here." And George Kaiser had enlisted because he was Jewish and wanted and knew that the Nazis were doing their best to destroy Jews in Europe, and so he wanted to do what he could to help them. So he said to his truck driver, "Let's go down there. This is why I'm fighting, to help these people." And his truck driver turned to him and said, "What do I want with some Jews? You go on your own." And, I think it's important for people to remember just how much anti-Semitism there was in this country in the 30s and 40s and even after the war. So George Kaiser went into Dachau on his own. And he, like so many other of the veterans, started immediately describing the smell, that even though he was still a good 4 miles, 5 miles away from the camp, suddenly the smell in the air became just almost overwhelming. And then he started describing how the leaves on the trees started turning gray, and couldn't comprehend that, and wiped his finger on one and ash came off the leaf. So I think what's so important to know about the liberators is that even though they had known the word concentration camp, even though they had known that the Nazis were out to destroy Europe's Jewry, that what they actually found in the camps was completely beyond their ability to imagine. And no division was at all warned by the upper echelons of the military about what it was they would find in these camps. Every single division stumbled upon a camp. The camp was not their destination. It was just en route to wherever they were going. So each man and woman who entered those camps had no preparation whatsoever. And if you think about that experience of the smell and then the ash on the leaves, and your mind just starts like what's going on here? And then at the exact same point in each liberator's narrative of walking through the gate of the camp, that is when they became unable to continue talking. Either they got up and left the room, or they broke down sobbing, or they literally froze in mid-sentence. And I realized that they were no longer in the room with me, that they had been transported back in time, and they were exactly back there, walking through the gate of Dachau or Buchenwald in April of 1945.
I've seen,
and that's what trauma is, right? You know, that kind of severe trauma.
I've seen that when I've interviewed veterans that have been in horrific battles, when they're inside the booth with me. At some point, they're no longer inside the booth with me. They're looking off, and they're seeing what they saw then. And mm-hmm. So I fully understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm. We talk about the camps, and I remember being in high school and learning about them and afterwards and talking. And, you know, there were a lot of World War II vets that were, I mean, they were in their 30s and at that time. And they, a lot of them would talk about things, but they didn't talk about the camps. And so what we learned about was through even some photographs, but it's an abstract thought. If you haven't put your feet in their shoes at the time, it's just abstract. Oh, this is awful. Who was it? Was it Stalin said the death of one person is a tragedy and the death of a million is a statistic?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, he was good at killing millions. So,
yeah. Well, he was.
I guess he would know. You know, I think that's what I tell my students is how much it requires of our imagination to even begin approaching the experience of these liberators, because we've grown up with the Holocaust as in our frame of reference, you know, and with some of these images. But these were all, you know, young 18, 19, 20-year-olds who had hardly ever traveled far from their hometowns, who had grown up during the Depression in pretty wholesome environments. And it was just really, you know, it's amazing that more people didn't just crack up at that moment that they walked through the camps.
Give us another story, if you would, please. I'm sorry.
Well, let me just say about George Kaiser that what makes me feel, glad for any pain that I caused him, or realize that it was worth it, was he wrote me a letter a few months ago and is now more than halfway through writing his memoir, and is grateful that he finally started expressing his memories to me, because he realized he needed to. Then there was another veteran whose name was Al Hirsch, and he was the one whose daughter was present at the interview. And he gave me some reasons for the silence of the veterans after they came back, because he said, first, what was my suffering compared to the survivors of those camps? How could I begin to talk about mine? And when they were the ones who had lived through it and suffered, and George Kaiser also said that. And another thing Al Hirsch experienced was just disbelief on the part of people he told, or lack of interest. And so he has struggled a great deal with anger towards the American public for their response, not to mention towards the Nazis. But as another veteran said to me, anger became my prison. And I only realized that about 30 years after the war that I had to liberate myself from the prison of the trauma and the anger. Al Hirsch used the word laminate. He said it all laminates. And what I found fascinating about that is that we laminate photographs to preserve them, right? And trauma keeps these moments of shock totally laminated in our minds. They never fade. They never take a back chair to other experiences. So I found, and he had his photographs also in his trunk, but he didn't keep his trunk in the basement of his office. It was in the den of the family living room. Mm. And his daughter had seen these photographs ever since she was a little girl. So it was that fascinated me, because even though she can't imagine her life without having seen these photographs, to have seen such horrible photographs from such a young age, and yet she's very close with her father. I mean, she was there during the interview. You could see this extremely deep bond between them that I felt very envious of. So I was like, you know, what would I rather have had? The childhood without those horrible photographs in them, and yet with a different type of trauma of losing my mother and the silence that followed, and not a closeness with my father, or what she had, which was exposure to those memories of his, mm-hmm. but this very deep closeness with him.
Can you hold on for just a moment,
sure.
please? My brother has phoned in, and I'd like to welcome him to Veterans Radio, Gene Lilly. Thanks for calling in.
Yes, I was not at the liberation of Dachau, thank
no.
God, but I was stationed in Ulm, Germany, and in 1956, and we had to make a supply pickup at an engineered supply depot near Dachau. When we were through, the driver of the Jeep said, asked if we'd like to visit Dachau. I didn't know what he meant. But we agreed to go, and we went, and Dachau had not been turned into a memorial at that time. I think the government had just started to undertake that. But we saw a lot that was probably like it was at the end of the war. And I just couldn't believe what I saw. And this bothered me for years. And I think I got my first computer about 1997 or 96, something like that. And one night my wife woke me up and she said, "You're having a nightmare. What's wrong?" Well, I had had another nightmare about Dachau. And I thought to myself, I've got to use this computer to get over it. So I researched Dachau and read all about it, how it was liberated, what the guys saw, how they reacted. And it got it out of my system. I can only imagine what your father, my God, I've got tears in my eyes. I can't believe it. I can only imagine what your father saw. And when we came back from the from seeing Dachau, we were very late, and we saw the lights on in the supply office, and we thought we better go report where we've been and why we're late. And
Gene, I want you to hold the rest of that, because that is part of the story I was telling Lila about, and we're coming on a break. But when we come back, I want you to tell that as a separate story what happened. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
Veterans, need help with your VA benefit claim? Then call Legal Help for Veterans right now at 800-693-4800. To ensure the best possible chance for success, our attorneys at Legal Help for Veterans are devoted to VA claim appeals, and they will forcefully present your particular case. So make that call today to Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800. 4800 for your no-charge consultation.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
We're back on Veterans Radio. We're talking to Lila Levinson, who has written a book, Gated Grief. And the more I talk and listen to Lila, and the more I browse through this book during the breaks, the more I realize what an important book it is that you wrote, Lila. And I imagine it did a lot for you. My brother's on the line also with us, Gene Lilly. And the next part of your story, Gene, is one that deserves being told as a separate story in my mind. What happened then?
Okay, on the way back to Ulm, I don't think any of us spoke. There were three guys in the Jeep. I don't think anyone spoke. We got back. We saw the lights on in the office. We better do a CYA and let the sergeant know why we're late. And we went in, and we told the sergeant where we had been, and he looked up from his desk, and he turned as white as a snowbank. He just turned white and got a very ill look on his face. And he looked at us and he said, "I liberated Dachau." And it sticks with me all these years, so I can just imagine. I can't imagine what your father went through. And thank you.
Thanks a lot, Gene, for telling that story. I'm so glad you did. Lila, as I said, this book is so incredibly important. And I think we just got an example of that from my own brother. He's told that story. I can't remember the first time I heard him tell the story. It might have been 30 years ago or more, but it's still sticks with me, and obviously you hear the emotion which he's always had on that incident of his, which was about 12 years after the war.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think I see all veterans as a brotherhood and sisterhood. But the ones who liberated the Nazi concentration camps really are in a group of their own. And unfortunately, you know, their silence, I think, has made it difficult for not just the American public, but for the whole world to recognize a couple of things. One, as you and I were talking before the show, Gary, the essence of human nature is to make us vulnerable to trauma. Even something as commonplace as being in a car accident or receiving bad news can be traumatic. But combat trauma is trauma of another whole degree altogether that only another veteran can really understand. And within that group, the men and women who witnessed the concentration camps, that's another whole degree of trauma, you know, that only those people can really understand. And I just feel like it is so important in terms of our commitment to peace and preventing genocide that we understand as much as we can the aftermath for the survivors, for the victims, and for the liberators. and that we need to make them part of the history of the Holocaust, and that we need to make the Holocaust more a part of World War II history.
Much
to my amazement, when I went to that weekend of the World War II Memorial Dedication in 2005, the entire weekend, Gary, at any of the story tents, at any of the panel discussions, the only time the word Holocaust or concentration camps was said was when President Bush gave a general address to everyone gathered. And I just couldn't understand that, because if you ask any veteran who liberated a camp, they will tell you that is when we realized why we were fighting this war. If we had known about these camps, the war would have ended 6 months earlier. You know, Eisenhower, when he witnessed Ordrup with Patton and Bradley, said to a soldier as he was leaving, who had said something disrespectful when Eisenhower was first going in, he said, "Maybe you haven't known up until now what you were fighting for, but you sure as hell know now what you've been fighting against." And so why haven't we more incorporated the history of the Holocaust into what World War II was about?
We have a museum here about 15 miles, maybe 20 miles from where I'm sitting in WDEO, Ave Maria Radio Network, our home station. That is the Holocaust Museum. I've not been in it. I've driven past it, and I remember it's a commercial strip of road, and then there's this somber, almost ugly building, and what is that doing here? And as you went past it, there's a little sign, Holocaust Museum. We were talking recently because of another guest that we had on a few months ago, a group called the Ritchie Boys, that we should do a remote from the Holocaust Museum. I have not been in it, but after the Ritchie Boys and after this, I know I'm going to be visiting it soon.
Yes, one of my veterans was one of the Ritchie Boys.
Oh, really?
And many of the Ritchie Boys liberated camps and witnessed the camps.
Yes, yes.
And one of them, his name was Cy Lewin. All of the Ritchie Boys were refugees from Germany, for your audience to know. And because of their fluency in German and their familiarity with Europe, they became part of a military, special military unit, and military intelligence unit. And Cy Lewin had been an artist before the war and became one after. And he created a 70-painting piece of work called The Journey, which very much expresses his experience of entering Buchenwald. And there, too, he had known to some degree what the Nazis were doing to Jews and political prisoners and homosexuals and Christian Scientists, but only when he walked into Buchenwald, you know, he again had the same exact shock and devastation. His work of art called The Journey, which your audience can actually see some of it online, his name's Cy, S-I, his last name's Lewin, L-E-W-E-N. It was that work that brought another level of emotional understanding to me of what these GIs had been through.
In case you're not aware of it, there is a tremendous documentary, The Ritchie Boys, available on DVD.
Yes, it is. It's fabulous. And it was done by a German filmmaker.
Isn't that interesting? Purging the guilt, the company, or the country guilt from his soul, I imagine. The steps that the liberators went through must have been the different steps that you hear in trauma. And the first one for them being shock, and the second one then being extreme anger, and that could be where the anger that your father felt, that he kept bottled up inside, but was, you know, that was taken out on you and the family. We've got 2 minutes left. What is it that we haven't covered that you want to cover in the last 2 minutes?
Well, just how extremely important it is. You know, finally, since Vietnam, we've begun to acknowledge as a society just how much combat affects its participants. And in the last 5 years, it sounds like even the military itself is recognizing it. And, you know, General Shinseki, who's now head of the VA, has been very committed to helping veterans recover from combat and to create meaningful, wholesome, loving lives again. But I see so much sign. Fort Hood is 45 minutes north of Austin, and many there's a campaign now among veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to keep men who are suffering and women who are suffering from trauma from being redeployed, because that is still happening. And so we have yet to really put into action what we know about PTSD to make real meaningful care available to the men and women who need it. And so that certainly has got to happen. And the other thing I'd like to emphasize is how critical it is that we offer help to the spouses and the children, because it's the family, the unit, that suffers. You know, the entire family does. And we're going to be suffering a huge epidemic of mental health crisis in this country from all of our veterans returning from these wars.
You're
unless
absolutely.
We give them what the resources that they deserve.
And a lot of that turns to crime, and there are veterans courts popping up around the country. If you have a loved one or an acquaintance who has committed a crime after the trauma of combat, research a little bit. Find out if there's a veterans court in the area. These are courts that handle the crimes that are committed by people who have been in combat. We've been talking to Lila Levinson, whose important book, Gated Grief, tells about the trauma of the family receives after the trauma the veteran receives. Join us next week for a very, very important and informative program. And until then, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on Veterans Radio are not necessarily views of this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio Network.
Veterans, need help with your VA benefit claim? Then call Legal Help for Veterans right now at 800-693-4800. To ensure the best possible chance for success, our attorneys at Legal Help for Veterans are devoted to VA claim appeals, and they will forcefully present your particular case. So make that call today to Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 for your no-charge consultation.